Welcome to another edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. We are broadcasting to you as usual at 96.3 FM here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. And we have in store for you lots of stuff piling up from the past, various interviews and tapes that I haven't been able to get out to you, but we'll be covering today on this September 12th show. Or are we at the 13th already? Well, we're somewhere in that area. Thursday, anyway. We'll be covering the Farmer's Market. Yesterday, three tickets were given to drummers at the Farmer's Market, and there was something of a brouhaha around that. I'll be playing some tapes around that. Interview with Brian Pollard, Street Roots editor in Portland, Oregon, and contact point with Camp Dignity, which is the urban camp in Portland, Oregon, which has been going for 8 or 9 months now, going strong. You probably read in the Sentinel that it was going down. Well, that's not true, and we're going to hear the straight dope from Brian in a recorded interview of about a week ago. We also may have some live call-ins, and we were going to have a guest live or two on the air, but that may not be happening because we're a little bit confused here at the management level, but we're still struggling. So we're going to begin straight away with the interview we actually promised you last time and didn't have time for, and that is the interview with Brian Pollard of Camp Dignity. We have our own Camp Paradise, of course, in Santa Cruz. That's the homeless, clean and sober campground that's been going kind of above board for the last 3 or 4 months, and of course for much longer than that, as a sort of a sub rosa, under the blankets, behind the bushes kind of deal, which of course most people have to do. Of the 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people, probably Camp Paradise is the only campground that is really right out there in the light of publicity, not because it decided it was a fun thing to do, but because Mayor Fitzmaurice came down there and the police followed shortly thereafter, and they had really no choice but to broadcast their existence to their supporters and ask for help in maintaining that camp area on the San Lorenzo River. It's about a block and a half away from Denny's on Ocean Street. You go to Denny's, you go down Felker Street to the river, and then you take the little dirt path up to the right along the river about 500 yards, and you get to Camp Paradise. So check it out. It is available for folks to... A lot of people are using it who are coming through. Some folks can't afford the rents. Some traditionally homeless folks in Santa Cruz, a variety of people there. And it's... Larry Templeton and Pam Isler are the folks who are at the middle of it, as well as a number of familiar suspects, Dirt Claude and Cookie and others. And they're usually quite welcoming. In fact, it's rare to find a time when they're not. They sometimes argue vigorously with each other and don't like it when the police come tromping around, but ordinary human beings are always welcome at Camp Paradise. But Camp Dignity, as it was first called, and Dignity Village, as is now known in Portland, Oregon, kind of evolved out of a strange situation where the camping ban in Portland, Oregon, including the sleeping ban sections, was thrown out in its entirety by Judge Gallagher as specifically discriminatory against homeless people. And several months after that, Street Roots, with its Out of the Doorways project, that's the homeless newspaper in Portland, and homeless people started a camp, Camp Dignity, which has moved from site to site. We're going to hear a little bit about its history from Brian. In fact, without further ado, let's hear about Camp Dignity, or Dignity Village, actually, as it's now called.
All right. We're on the line with Brian Pollard of Street Roots newspaper in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Robert.
How are you?
I'm doing quite well. We've had some busy times up here.
Well, I know the AP Wire said that Dignity Village, which is the, I guess, 8-month-old village, which Street Roots is Out of the Doorways project largely put together and has been self-sufficient and homeless run, although migratory for the last, since last half year and more, kind of got at least the media said that it was being disbanded, but that's not true?
Well, it is and it isn't. The city offered an alternative site for the village to relocate to, and the site was pretty disagreeable to many people in the camp because where they were being relocated to was an asphalt surface similar to a parking lot. It's where the city composts its leaves, but it's in the off season, so it's just an asphalt lot right now. It was surrounded by a chain link fence, and it's pretty remotely located. It's on the very, very outskirts of the city, not too far from the Columbia River, which is the northern border of Portland.
Hard for people to reach?
Yes. It did have, there is a bus that goes out there, but that bus line only runs during weekdays. And if, for whatever reason, the bus schedule doesn't work with you, then it was pretty difficult to get around. The other thing was that the closest store was a mini mart, which was 2 miles away.
Wow.
So it was pretty remotely located, and a lot of people had philosophical problems. They felt like they were being sent to a concentration camp.
Can you give us a sense of what the kinds of sites that Dignity Village has been to in the last 8 months?
Well, most of the sites that they've been to have been much more close to the center of the city. Obviously, it's important for most of the folks in the village to be in the inner part of the city because that's where the social services that they access are. The different pre-clinics, showers, clothing closets, food sites, the services that they need and use are in the core of the city, and so to be very remotely located makes it problematic for a lot of the folks who live in the village.
So for example, what's the site they're on now that they have to leave?
The site they're on, that they were on, was an ODOT, Oregon Department of Transportation plot of land beneath the Fremont Bridge.
Was it asphalt or cement or?
No, it was a grassy field.
Mm-hmm. And generally the folks have been on a grassy field? Or?
Yes, all the sites have been on just kind of flat grassy surfaces.
And is there a reason that that's, say, an advantage over asphalt or concrete? Speaking as a complete idiot on the camping scene.
the advantages to being on grass are, number one, that it doesn't reflect heat, and so you're not baking on the surface. Obviously, it's softer because you're sleeping in a tent. Some people don't necessarily have padding or mattresses or whatever that they can sleep on. And also, there's just that aesthetic quality of being on the earth, as opposed to being on a paved surface.
And I guess Portland is famous for its rain. What does the rain do to Dignity Village?
The ODOT site that they were on was kind of a little hill, and so it did pretty well. And also, it was underneath a bridge, and so it didn't get a lot of hard direct rain. It was sheltered, and most of the rain that it would get was mostly just stuff that would kind of get blown under the bridge. And then it also drained pretty well because it tapered down toward the edges of the camp.
I think a village of about 60 to 80 people?
It was about 75 people, but since they relocated 2 days ago, The camp has been split. The city did not forcibly split them up. They chose rather to split up. Some people decided to go to the city-sanctioned site. The people with more significant disabilities and transfer of mobility issues went to, some went to a supporter's home in Forest Grove, some went to a supporter's home in Westland, some people went to the farming co-op that we have in Vancouver, and other people just decided that they didn't want to deal with the politics of it anymore, and they kind of
dissolved into the great urban beast.
I'm sorry?
Dissolved into the great urban beast, perhaps.
Yes. So the situation that we're looking at now is Dignity Village has effectively broken up into about four or five groups. And those groups hope to rejoin once the village has found a permanent site. But right now, the majority of the village is at the city-sanctioned site, which is called Sunderland Yard, or the Sunderland site.
Uh-huh. Now, how were the previous sites chosen? Were they just were they chosen through negotiations with the city, or did folks just sort of go squat there? What was the deal?
No, the Sunderland Yard site is the first site that the city had a say in. Before that, the village had a site selection committee that looked at different sites around the city. They looked at sites that they thought would be suitable for the village, and then they would research who owned them, were they public, were they private, if they were public, what agency had control of them, and they would decide, they would look at the merits of each site and decide where they were going to go. A couple of the sites they went to strictly for political reasons to demonstrate to the city that if they weren't willing to work with the village, that the village was going to place itself exactly where they did not want them to be.
And what sites were those?
The most prominent example of that was the River Place site. The River Place is a very affluent part of town, right on the Willamette River. There's a walking shopping mall along the river. A lot of people go down there, they jog and they shop, and there's condominiums all around, and there was just happened to be an empty lot that was yet to be developed. It was slated for development, but it had not actually had any construction on it yet, and they placed themselves there, and that move was the pivotal point where the city realized, okay, we need to start talking with these people.
Wow.
And it was actually the very day that we moved to that site that Commissioner Eric Sten called me and said, hey, let's meet with you tomorrow morning. And that was the meeting that began our negotiations with the city that have led to where we are now.
The infamous squeaky wheel syndrome?
Yes.
And what month did you move to that site?
The River Place site?
Uh-huh.
Oh boy, that was, I think, in March.
And how long did you stay there?
1 week.
Did you have a good time mingling with the gentry?
Actually, you know, the city said that there was a large outcry from the local residents, but if that's the case, the village didn't really experience any of that. They seem to enjoy their short stay there, but I think we're happy to move on to their next site.
Uh-huh. So how many people in the camp are actually employed generally at any one time? Because I think that would be a factor in wanting to be able to get to work, and I guess might be a concern of some of the folks who didn't want to move far away from the downtown.
Absolutely. I would say roughly 50%,
uh-huh.
50 to 70%
uh-huh.
work in some capacity. Either they have a full pull a part-time job, or they do temp work or day labor.
Mm-hmm. So the site itself has been cleared, right? The site under the Fremont Bridge, did you say it was?
Yes.
And was that forcefully by the police or voluntarily by folks? Or both?
Well, it was a little of both. Like I said, the negotiations that we had been doing with the city over the last few months had all been under the condition that on September 1st, the village was going to be leaving the site. And that was under orders from ODOT. And the police were poised to enforce trespass at the behest of ODOT.
Uh-huh. Now, go ahead. I'm sorry. You're going to say something?
Well, I was just going to say that although the village wasn't excited about leaving that site because the alternative that they had been given was somewhat disagreeable, they did leave voluntarily. In other words, the police did not come in and forcibly move them.
Uh-huh.
And so it was somewhat voluntary in the sense that there was no police presence that was standing by saying, all right, you got to go or this baton is coming down on your head.
Uh-huh. Is this the standard way that the... There's at the end of any particular site's duration, I remember talking to Jack Tafari in San Francisco when he was down. He was saying that usually the Dignity Village folks had a kind of an alternative where they would do a shopping cart parade to another site and so forth in order to demonstrate to the populace that, you know, they were being, in essence, forced to move,
mm-hmm.
And I guess that's what each site has, in essence, been a forced move, right? It hasn't been moving to a better site.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate?
I'm sorry, what was the... I didn't understand the question.
Is it accurate to say that people have moved from one site after another, not because they found a better site, but because they were forced to move from that site?
Well, again, that's kind of yes and no. Each move has been voluntary in the sense that the village has cooperated with the city's demands to move.
But the city's demands have been motivating the move?
Yeah, absolutely.
You didn't suddenly get a better idea, oh, let's go up on the hill because it's nicer up there.
Right.
Right. So you are optimistic, I guess, when we talked earlier, we haven't talked about this on tape, about a city council meeting where for the first time in a precedent-setting decision, the city council of Portland, Oregon agreed at 4-1 vote to allow, well, to negotiate with CAMP, I should say it's Dignity Village now, and to, actually allow them to administer a site?
Yeah, it's certainly precedent-setting in Portland. In Portland, since 1981, we've had a very oppressive anti-camping ordinance, which was found unconstitutional last September. And
since that time, police haven't been able to use it, or they've been using it anyway?
No, they have stopped using it, and the case is still in litigation.
Uh-huh.
The appeal actually should be up for a hearing soon.
Does that mean people camping elsewhere are not disturbed, or that they are simply disturbed under other ordinances?
Well, Dignity Village, one of the ripples that it has sent through the community is that other campers have gotten a little more bold, and villages much smaller and less organized than Dignity Village are cropping up around the city now. The city does not seem to be enforcing the law as brutally as they used to.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not sure what's going to happen in the future. What is happening is that when the city wants to move a camp or break up a camp, instead of using the anti-camping ordinance, they just use another law like trespass.
Uh-huh. Which is a little more complex because it's a misdemeanor, right? Or is your camping ordinance also a misdemeanor?
Yes.
So you get a jury trial, in theory, for camping offenses?
Yes, absolutely.
Time for jury nullification, then.
And, you know, we're hoping that as people get cited with trespass, that we'll be able to mount a legal battle against that, because the argument is that we'll use is that they're using the trespass law in the same discriminatory way that the anti-camping law was used.
Uh-huh. And that was one of the key arguments, right, in killing the anti-camping law, that it was against homeless people.
Yes, that was one part of it, was that it was being used in a discriminatory fashion against people who had no other alternative but to camp outside.
We're talking to Brian Pollard of Street Roots, one of the best organized, most extensive homeless newspapers in the country, which is sold on the streets by homeless people. Brian, Dignity Village then is sort of been partially relocated to this new out-of-the-way site that the city has agreed to?
Yes, they are relocated there for 60 days, and while they're there, the organizers of the campaign, in cooperation, supporters and folks in the village are pursuing other permanent sites. We have several supporters that have offered to purchase land for the village, and there are a couple of sites that are being looked at very closely right now, and we hope to have a permanent site lined up hopefully within 30 days, so that the folks that have been split up into different groups will be able to come back together on a site that they can call theirs.
And this will be a downtown site or a pastoral out in the country site?
It's not likely to be downtown, but it's also not going to be rural. It will be more
somewhere in the middle of the Columbia River, perhaps.
It will be closer to downtown than they are now, but not as close as the ODOT site.
Now, you sound pretty sanguine about this, and I guess you were enthused speaking about this city council meeting where you said they had a 3.5-hour meeting, and some council members, including the mayor, made some very positive statements about Dignity Village, although one council member was very bigoted and negative.
Mm-hmm.
But is that the general opinion in Dignity Village, or is there some angry feelings there as well?
Well, it's pretty split. I've heard some very negative things. Some of the more conservative talk radio hosts have been rallying people to call City Hall. I even heard today that one of the talk radio hosts in town encouraged people to drive by the site and throw bricks.
Really?
Yeah, which, of course,
who is that fine talk show radio host?
Yeah, well, that's also a violation of FCC guidelines, and I hope somebody files a complaint against him, because you can't encourage people to do criminal acts over the radio waves.
Well, here at Free Radio, we say fuck the FCC, but we don't like that kind of criminal behavior, that's for sure.
Right.
Now, what about among the campers themselves? Is there much anger at the city council, or is there resignation, or is there mixed feeling?
I think there's a level of acceptance that the politicians are politicians, and they do what they do, just as the village people do what they do. I think that they are pleased, for the most part, that the city is at least offering to help them. Now, what that help looks like in the future is still to be determined. But like I said, I mean, the city has already done some very unprecedented things in cooperating with the village, and I think the village recognizes that.
What about those who haven't come to the village? Are they just saying, look, we don't like this particular site, but we're happy the city is trying to do something, or are they pissed that they have to move from the Oregon transportation site?
Well, some of the village was definitely unhappy with having to move because they see the ODOT site as being public land, and so they see it as the people's right to occupy that land if the need exists. However, I think most people in the village are less political in that philosophical debate and more interested in just having a safe place to stay where they're not going to be harassed and victimized.
Well, should folks down here be sending messages to the mayor demanding that they are commending them, condemning them, or something in the middle?
I think that it's very important for everyone in the city of Portland and anyone that's aware of homeless issues anywhere in the nation, that if they want to support the Dignity Village effort, that they can write or call or email any of the city council members or the mayor of Portland and just let them know that they support the resolution that they passed to help Dignity Village. And that they encourage them to continue that support and increase it in the future.
You know, Seattle has done a similar thing for Cher, the campground up there that's been mobile in the urban setting. Have they done the same thing or not, you know?
Not to my knowledge.
So Portland is sort of unique in this respect?
It is somewhat unique. I think that a city cooperating with an innovative project like this is not new. I think it's been done in the past. And of course, you know, if you look at what happened with the WPA under Roosevelt, I mean, there have been efforts like this in the past, organized efforts to help people at the grassroots level that don't have a place to stay. But I think in modern times, certainly in the city of Portland, this has not been done.
Now, as you probably know, here in Santa Cruz, we have Camp Paradise, which in our own kind of smaller way, although I guess Camp Paradise is almost as large as Dignity Village, has about 60 people. It still continues, although again under threat from the police, city manager, and so forth, and reassurance by the mayor that it is an illegal encampment. Now the Community Housing Land Trust is meeting on Tuesday in a proposal by kind of a dissident member of City Council to consider nonprofit management of the camp under homeless direction, but with, you know, kind of different groups like the Quakers involved and so forth. So that's happening down here. I encourage you, if you can, since some of your folks may be in exile, to exile yourselves down this way to give us some expertise.
Well, we certainly want to help any effort that's happening anywhere in the United States, and we hope that once the village gets its feet underneath it a little bit more, gets a little more organized, that we'll be able to reflect on what we've done and maybe even offer the service of consultation, maybe write a book, maybe an instructional video on how to do this, how to create a safe, viable, alternative living situation for people who are on the streets. Because our struggle, you know, we've learned a lot of things, we've done some things wrong, but we've done some things right. And I think we have a lot of information to share with people that are in a similar struggle.
And your wisdom come out of both, of course. We've been talking to Brian Pollard, who's a Street Roots editor and a worker with Dignity Village in Portland, Oregon. I'd like to talk to you longer, but I got to run to another court process down here in Santa Cruz. Hey, hope to pick up those Street Roots from you, and I guess you're going to be sending down a videotape of that historic council meeting where the Portland City Council decided to support Dignity Village.
Absolutely.
And anything finally you want to say to any of the folks down here at Free Radio?
Good luck to Camp Paradise, and we hope that their struggle has becomes as fruitful as ours has.
Sounds good to me.
And that was Brian Pollard up in Portland, Oregon, talking to me about two or three days ago. You tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, of course, 96.3 FM, and I'm your host, Bathrobe's Pierre Robert Norris. Call-in number, easy to remember, is 427-3772, 427-3772. Lines are open if you want to ask questions, have answers, make comments, you name it. This is your show. Our specialty is civil rights for folks outside. And, of course, Dignity Village and a community is really the first step in getting those kinds of civil rights. You can't really beg, borrow, or steal them from courts and city councils with the same kind of solidarity that you can by getting a community together of like, not even so much like-minded people, but folks who are in similar circumstances and supporting each other. And I think that is what's happening in Santa Cruz with a lot of campsites all over Santa Cruz, particularly with ones like Camp Paradise, where you have more support from the community, a sort of a, I don't want to say quasi-legal status, because the police, city manager, assistant city manager, and city council members seem to have made it real clear that this is something they don't like, that it violates their precious camping ban, the law that criminalizes 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people here in Santa Cruz every night, not just for camping, but also it has a sleeping ban section, which criminalizes actually the act of falling asleep, whether in a vehicle or outside or in any structure that is not a house or hotel. And that's, of course, the situation for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of homeless people out there, about 60 of them maybe in Camp Paradise. I'd hope to get through to them for another interview and update, but having trouble reaching them on the phone. If any Camp Paradise folks are listening and want to call in with an update, that would be great. Call-in number again is 427-3772. I also spoke with attorney Kate Wells, who apologizes for not being able to come on the air. She has a splitting headache. Last time I saw her was in the courtroom of former DA, now Judge Art Danner, or Drumhead Art Danner, as I used to call him in the street shit sheet. He was presiding over the case of Richard Quigley, the question of whether a motorcycle helmet needs to be worn, or what actually constitutes a motorcycle helmet, since the standards in the law are very, very unclear. If that's the case, then can an individual motorcycle people with helmets that they choose be held responsible if the cop feels that the helmet does not meet the criterion? What is the criterion? That really is the issue in the trial. And I saw part of that trial over in Danner's court in the jailhouse the other day. Wasn't able to stay for all of it, and I don't know if it's concluded. I think that it's still going on, or else there's some question, because I think Richard Quigley didn't show up for the next court appearance, and it's not clear what's going on with it. We may give him a call and try to get some information from him later. Jim Costner is the activist who is going to trial on Monday, the 17th, in Department 24 in San Jose, not Santa Cruz, but San Jose, over the hill, for the felony vandalism charge of smashing the Columbus statue in San Jose City Hall with a sledgehammer. And that happened back in, I guess it was March or April. And he's been languishing in jail for the last couple of months, even though he made bail through slippery dealings by the DA. And he has not been able, really, to even get his court file until Wednesday. Finally, former attorney Larry Hildes was able to get it to him in the main jail at San Jose. All his papers, all the evidence that Hildes was given. But according to Hildes, Jim Costner has not been able, for example, to have access to audio and video equipment so he can actually view the videotape of his alleged confession, or the audio tapes of other people's testimony that were made. Also, he has not had access in any regular way to a law library, except for, I think, on one occasion that he's mentioned to me on the phone. And finally, most importantly, again, these documents that he should have had access to for the last several weeks to prepare for this serious felony trial, for which he could spend 3.5 years in prison if found guilty, only reached him on Wednesday. They were sent to him several weeks ago, but the jail refused to deliver them, claiming they were a security risk. Maybe the truth in the files would burn the hands of the deputies, I don't know. They were sent back to attorney Hildes, and he finally had to deliver them in person. Couldn't come down on Tuesday because all jails were shut down, or locked down, as they say, because of the New York World Trade Center Pentagon destruction. So he just got the stuff on Wednesday. So I haven't heard from Jim recently. I'm going to be going down to San Jose. Going down to San Jose on Monday when the trial starts. I'm really hoping that he'll be given a continuance, because he obviously needs that time to prepare his case, to spend some time in the law library, to contact the witnesses. I and a number of other people, Becky Johnson, Laura Tucker, David Silva, are going to be character witnesses for Jim, testifying that he's not a violent person and that he is a man of principle, trying to bring to the public awareness certain important issues. That's the purpose of this Columbus statue smashing, that he's not some sort of mad dog lunatic who just goes around smashing statues for the hell of it or engaging in violence of that sort. And I think that's been my experience with Jim. Whatever other difficulties he's had in this community and other problems that have arisen in terms of his sometimes overly passionate commitment to certain causes, some have accused him, I among them, of acting prematurely and in a lone wolf fashion, perhaps not in the most prepared and would you say a way that consults with other people. Anyway, I'll be going to San Jose to testify as a witness, and I'm hoping that trial will be postponed. If you want more information about the trial, you can give a call to the Huff line, 423-HUFF, and I'll try to get back to you. That's a voicemail for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and Jim has often put himself on the line for struggling against the sleeping ban. He was one of the people who stepped up to the plate to resist the crackdown, the threatened crackdown against Camp Paradise. And indeed, that crackdown is, you know, it's not here, and maybe it's not even coming in the next few days or maybe the next few weeks. But, for example, I spoke with Michael Schmidt, who had a conversation with Christopher Krohn either today or yesterday, just sort of in passing, and Krohn sort of made a comment that unless Camp Paradise found another site, that there would in essence be some trouble there, that they better find another site fast rather than the river site. And I've advised people at Camp Paradise myself that I think the police are going to move on the first heavy rain that comes down the pike, calling it a public safety hazard or a trip and fall menace or whatever you will, like they did with the Coral Street Open Air Shelter, the Back 40 campground back in 1995 when Kennedy and Rotkin and Daryl Darling and Paul Merceau moved to close that campground down, even though there had been a heavy rain and though it was flooded for a brief period of time. They were able to bring in planks and essentially hoist and elevate the camp up and pump it out. And it was a place that homeless people wanted and needed to stay at and were actually relatively safe at compared with the casualties that followed the destruction of that campground. So I think it's important that Camp Paradise folks find another site as well to move to if need be, or they will be, I think, just dispersed is my fear. And also I think the community needs to find a way to have a clear response to the threat of rogue police action or just temperamental city council, who cares about the damn homeless response, or we have to enforce the law no matter what, or perhaps responding to the rather, I think, they're peculiar concerns of the River Task Force. I'm going to talk about those in a moment.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. Man, I'm not sure. I might be in trouble because of being a friend of yours, man, I swear. This little thing gets crazier and crazier.
Oh, what's the problem here?
Oh, I don't know. You know the background. Most people listen. God, I don't know how to get them started in on understanding the background. But on that complaint that we're lodging.
Well, I remember that at the Monday Citizens Police Review Board, you and Marilyn Weaver both spoke about a complaint you had regarding police behavior around a police call you made concerning an incident that happened with Marilyn's son, is that right?
Right. And during the time, you know, that when he hit her, he also, broke a tape recorder. I told you about that. You know, we had a tape recorder like you do, and mm-hmm. she was trying to record him and his madness, you know, and he took it away from her and broke it.
Mm-hmm.
And so Officer Habe came over and got
Lieutenant Habe, actually.
Lieutenant Habe, yeah, mm-hmm. okay, whatever.
Hey,
he came over and got it for me. I didn't think at the time to get a receipt for it or write anything down about it. And he did ask me at the time if I had, a receipt from him, if I had the receipt or, you know, anything, the box that came in or anything. And actually at that time I said, No, I've got it about a year. I doubt if I have any of that anymore. I think I probably registered it.
I should warn you, Doug, we have someone calling in a few minutes, so cut to the chase if you can.
Well, someone called in, actually, and told the police that that tape recorder actually was theirs, and they just loaned it to us, and that they didn't really care about it, and that they could just drop the charges. And this is what we've been told, so they're going to dismiss the charges. Do you understand that?
Mm-hmm. Again, this is not...
We do have the receipt and everything.
Right,
this has to do with the...
Yeah, this isn't a police matter. This, of course, is a district attorney deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is another kind of another layer. But and I understand this has personal import to you, but how would you suggest this has importance for those folks out there in the community that they want to...
Dealing with the police, and make sure you got receipts on things. When the police come by... Officer Hebe, you know, he came by, and I was really stupid, and I just gave him the evidence right there, and, you know, said, well, here, you know, I'm thinking like your president's, I mean, your policeman's your friend. That's a slip, too. Your president's your friend, too. Yeah. But anyway, you know, you need to find out and get stuff, get everything received.
Oh, yeah, it's important to have witnesses. It's important. I mean, I tape record most conversations I have with the police because I think that, you know, I mean, it depends, of course. But, I mean, certainly if a police officer, the first thing you do if you're a suspect is to say nothing. You say, I don't want to say anything. I want to talk to an attorney.
Man,
thank you very much.
Suspect. We're like, we were the
complainants. Right, you're the complainants.
It's so weird.
And
anyway.
And if you're making a complaint, it's often good to keep, or particularly if it's about the police, or even if it's just you're trying to use the police to assist you, it's good to keep a record. You're right. Receipts are important. Witnesses are important.
But don't be giving anything to the police, man.
Right.
He's the only person that thought I didn't have. Well, actually, I do. I found the receipt in the box that came in, so we got to go to court tomorrow and tell them, you know, hey, here's the box and receipt. They were treating us like it was real funny. Like actually, someone made an affidavit out that it was their tape player.
I see.
And
well, you know, you're a man who has been critical of some police officers. Although you've also, I think, you've tried to be fair too. For
on the radio, especially
with Officer Seeley, for instance.
With you, that's what I was talking about. Being your friend might cause problems, man.
Well, you could always declare you're my enemy and see what happens.
You owe me one, man.
Hey, thank you for calling, Doug.
Okie dokie.
All right.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Well, there you have it. The best thing to do is never form any kinds of friendships with suspicious types like myself. And I suppose that's good advice if you want to lead a quiet life. And I don't know. I don't hear a lot of concern that people are harassed because they are on friendly terms with me, but I imagine some are. And certainly I occasionally get my share of harassment. And although I think it's ironically true that those who are more upfront with things and are willing to defend their rights, I think, in the end, suffer, although it varies, of course, but I think frequently suffer less harassment. The police are a little warier of going after them because the bully syndrome doesn't work if you know the person's going to fight back. I don't believe, for example, that Steve Elliott, Rockman D, Rockman Downtown, as I call him, the guy who does little rock sculptures, or used to before the police kind of scared him away from doing that, even though he won a case in court on that issue, and then won another case when Sergeant Baker came around with his ticket book, gave him a ticket for having his panhandling sign, which said disabled on it, and he's still afraid to put that sign back up again, though he has a sort of a more limited sign, doesn't use the word disabled, even though it's quite legal for him to do so. He's afraid he's going to be harassed by Sergeant Baker, and it's like something had happened yesterday at the farmer's market. In fact, I'm going to begin to kind of cue in to the farmers markets. There's a whole an hour and a half of tape I made at the farmers market. Obviously, we can't play it all, and it probably isn't all airworthy. But the upshot of the farmers market situation was that drummers, after being harassed the last few weeks, first of all, after being driven away from the red church across the street from the farmers market, where they traditionally would gather and do some drumming throughout the afternoon and dancing, and then moved to the whole scene on the sidewalk next to the farmers market has been moved. All the political tables have been kind of moved off into a little ghetto area, and everything's been meshed off with kind of an orange or now a green mesh. We have an incoming call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. It's Hanley Spires.
Ah, now you actually are the person that I was going to introduce, but haven't introduced yet. Let me just quickly finish this up, Pamela. The farmers market really became a matter of great controversy yesterday, so we're going to be going into that after our interview here with Pamela, who I guess I'm going to let her speak for herself. We, I guess, first ran into each other 3-4 years ago.
About 3 years ago.
And you were experiencing some problems with, I think, the deputies and then with the police. And you were quite outspoken about them, and you actually went on mainstream media to talk about them, and you've written a kind of a rather well-constructed statement about it. You read part of it to me a couple nights ago.
Yes. Instead of getting better, it's gotten a lot worse.
Oh, dear.
Much, much worse. And the side effects that from it are that, you know, some people believe anything they're told, and the offshoots from that are I am harassed terribly all the time, physically and emotionally. And I assumed that coming on the radio and just telling the story like it really happened and what really went on, maybe it'll stop. Yeah. Maybe people stop and listen. And if it's okay, I'll start reading.
Not at all. I think some will listen, certainly.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay, my name is Pamela Lee Spires. I am 40 years old. I'm the mother of two wonderful children, disabled in a power chair. I'm the survivor of 10 surgeries, 2 heart attacks, and 3 strokes. 3 years ago, living there for 6 years in a tiny subsidized rent apartment in one of the worst neighborhoods in town, the landlord decided he could make more money and refused to renew the lease after all those years. Even offering the $1,000 increase when we went to court couldn't sway him. So I went on the local community channel and described my plight and that of my children. 2 weeks later, in the Seabreeze Motel, it was called the West Wind back then, the police arrived on the last morning we were paid up for. Santa Cruz police, actually. My son had already left for Safeway on Soquel to cash a paycheck to pay for more time. It was 9:30 a.m. on October 17, 1998. The officers were beyond rude, screaming at me to get out of the bed and pack the room up. When I protested and said that money would be here before the 11 a.m. checkout time to pay for more time, they said I was being arrested for trespassing, that management didn't want me there. There was no such word from the motel office, and I was extremely confused. They kept trying to get me out of the room, but I wouldn't go anywhere until my son got back. I was very afraid. I have never been arrested or in jail in my life. They forced me into my wheelchair and knocked my belongings out of my hands, breaking several items. They then dragged me to the police car and threw me in. They put my manual wheelchair in the trunk of the car and proceeded to the county jail on Water Street in Santa Cruz. I was handed over to the sheriff deputies without ever being read my rights in any way, shape, or form. I was beaten and terrorized for over 12 hours. Around 1:30 a.m. on October 18, 1998, I was let go in nothing but a pair of shorts and a t-shirt. I didn't know where my son was, and I had placed my daughter in a home her school principal suggested, not having any help or family locally. I was becoming hypothermic and noticed a red phone on the wall. It only dialed 911. I called, crying in pain and shock, with bruises and contusions all over me. A Santa Cruz police officer showed up but wouldn't come near me. He used his personal cellular phone to call a handicab. The cab arrived and the officer told the driver to follow him. He led the driver to a local motel called the Pacific Inn. The officer paid for a room for one night and left, not listening to me when I tried to tell him what happened. I was terrified. I didn't feel I could call anyone for help at this point. They put me in the room closest to the check-in desk, right across from it, actually. It took forever to get warm, longer to stop crying, and even longer to fall asleep. Shortly after 7 a.m. on October 18, 1998, the manager let himself into the room and told me to get out. I had no idea where to go or what to do. I sat in the parking lot in the rain for hours. A man in a plumbing van showed up, and I asked him for his phone. He let me use it, and I called Terry at Yellow Cab. She sent a cab out to me, and they took me to the homeless drop-in center on Coral Street, where I began a nightmare I never, never dreamed I would be in. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Do you want to continue, or do you want to...
Oh, I have to. I really have to.
Okay, go ahead. We're talking with Pamela Lee Spires. And you're reading an account of something that happened about...
3 years ago.
Go ahead.
Unfortunately, that wasn't the only incident. In between the time of trying to find a home, income being a major problem, I met someone, fell in love, and we tried leaving Santa Cruz, going to another area, and tried to start over. We found an apartment in Sacramento. And one day something really odd happened. I still think these incidents are linked somehow or another. I'm not sure how. But a woman came running into our apartment. We had the door open for the summer breeze, and she ran straight into our bathroom. I didn't know this woman, neither did my husband. The next thing we knew, at least 15 deputy sheriffs arrived. I had been laying in the bed asleep when the woman had run in. I had awakened when she had run into the room and called out for Timothy. Timothy didn't show up. 5 deputies did, screaming at me to get out of the bed. When I pointed to them the wheelchair at the foot of the bed, they didn't give a damn. They grabbed me by a leg and an arm and yanked me off the bed and threw me on the floor, where they proceeded to kick me with their boots. They ruptured a disc in my lower spine. They beat on my husband when he tried to come and help me when I was screaming his name. And he happens to be a victim of 10 gunshot wounds and a survivor of cancer. Between the two of us, we might make one body, we say. They hit him right in his wounded areas and knocked him to the ground. They put handcuffs on me so tight my wrists were bleeding. I don't know how, but I got to the phone and dialed 911 screaming for help. I was told by the person who answered the phone that if I didn't stop playing with the 911 system, I would go to jail. I threw the phone, and I was hit by the phone by one of the deputies. This is in Sacramento. They took my husband out of the apartment. They brought him back in. They had already taken the shoelaces out of his shoes because they were just so sure we were criminals because of the color of my husband's skin and our income. They just thought for sure we were criminals. Screaming at us, we know you're in violation of something somewhere. We know you're on probation. When they got the reading back from their office that we were not on parole or under any violation anywhere, they became really angry and threw him on the floor next to me, waving a citation in front of my face, saying if I didn't sign it, they were going to take him to jail and I would never see him again. Well, I signed the citation, but I didn't sign my name. And I did not receive a copy. They left with everything and just left. They just left us there on the floor. I was in shock. He was in pain. I was in pain. I was bleeding. We couldn't call anybody. Who were we going to call? The people who were supposed to protect us had done this. I didn't feel safe there anymore either. We came back to Santa Cruz because that's where my daughter was.
What year did this incident happen?
This happened in 1999.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And we came back to Santa Cruz because my daughter was there, here, and I knew wherever we would go, we wouldn't be safe. It didn't matter anymore. Well, in September 2000, I was hospitalized with a pretty bad infection from sleeping on the streets for almost a year. It seems once you get into that drop-in center on Coral Street, it's impossible to get out. People look at you as damaged goods. They don't try to understand why you end up there. They don't care. Some do, but don't know how to help. Some do, can't help. Some do, won't help. And I have gone through hell and back trying just to get a roof over my head, which I finally have, but at the expense of my husband's freedom. In September 2000, I became ill and was hospitalized. Community Action Board of Santa Cruz gave us a motel room after I was discharged, and we were at the Peter Pan Motel on Ocean Street. A couple of other homeless people we knew who worked during the day and had no place to stay at night asked us if they could sleep on the floor. We said yes, as long as they could help out with food. One of the people who showed up, we didn't know everything we needed to know about. And she spent one night with us. I told Timothy never again. She acted very inappropriately, and I told him I wasn't going to deal with that. She didn't come back the second night. The third afternoon, she came back around. Now, my husband is no angel, but he's no criminal either. Him and a friend had been getting high that day.
High on?
On cocaine.
Uh-huh.
We have never, never said that this wasn't so. We have never denied this.
Mm-hmm.
He has a problem. He was working on it, and we've never denied this to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
This young girl shows up. She decides she's going to jump into the middle of the drugs and expect to be able to stay there. Well, when she was told that she couldn't stay, she was very, very angry. She left, and 5 o'clock the next morning, Santa Cruz Police Department once again showed up banging on the motel door. My husband got up, answered the door. They told him to get dressed. And they handcuffed him and took him out of the room. The next thing I know, this officer comes in taking 20 pictures of 5 beer cans and a picture of a bed that somebody's been sleeping in for 6 hours. Not this girl, somebody else. And I kept asking them, why are you here? What is going on? Why are you here? They wouldn't respond to me. And then finally, after they had taken all these pictures and they had Timothy in the car, they come over and tell me, well, he's being arrested for sexual assault. My husband has way too much more respect for himself and women to even think about doing that. I was in that room that night. I was coherent. I am not a drug user. I was there. My husband never touched this woman, who wasn't a child. She was 21 years old, unlike what the papers stated. He's in San Quentin prison right now for something he didn't do.
Now, this was was he convicted in a trial, or?
For 2 weeks, they wouldn't let me see him when he was in county, and I just got a picture last week. This is why I decided to call you.
Mm-hmm.
And he's full of bruises. His face is swollen. And I believe he was beaten and forced to plead out to something he didn't do. I have the picture with me right now. I will show it to anybody who cares.
So let me understand. This arrest happened a year ago?
Yes, and what happened was I've been all along trying to get help, and for some reason I can't seem to get help. On April 28th of this year, I was found unconscious and not breathing on my apartment floor with a skull fracture.
Mm-hmm.
I have no memory of the day. I have no memory of the 2 weeks following. I don't know what happened. I know I don't really want to remember, but I do believe it was a warning.
Now, but regarding this matter with Timothy, he was arrested for sexual assault. And
yes.
And what happened? Was he on parole or probation? Was it violated? What was the deal?
He was never on parole or on in violation of anything.
So how did he end up in San Quentin at all?
What happened was, okay, I asked the women from the Women's Crisis Center to listen to the testimony that this woman gave.
Mm-hmm.
They told me they knew she was lying. But there was nothing they could do.
Mm-hmm.
The DA, they listened to her testimony. They took the case out of her hands and ran with it themselves.
Mm-hmm. So he was convicted?
He was convicted after we went through 3 public defenders who did nothing to aid him.
Who were the names of the public defenders?
I know Nancy De La Pena was one.
Mm-hmm.
And the other 2 lawyers were out of her office.
Uh-huh.
I have to look up the rest of the names, but
they
did absolutely nothing.
When was he convicted?
March 12th,
uh-huh.
The day we got married.
And was he free during that time, or was he in jail?
Never.
They jailed him throughout that entire period?
Yes. He was in county from September 2000 until March 25th, 2001, and then they sent him to San Quentin.
And this is an African-American?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you yourself are Anglo?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have a black son.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as some people are concerned, I'm black.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I deserve the treatment that they give me. I've dealt with prejudice for over 20 years. I've lived it. And what they've done to my husband is beyond excuse. It's despicable. It's deplorable. and they all need to have their jobs taken away from them.
So, you, of course, your concerns are, I guess, with a variety of agencies here, but have you finished reading your account?
That's the gist of it. There's a lot more, but mm-hmm. not as violent.
Mm-hmm.
I've had reactions from the citizens of this county who feel they have a bandwagon to jump on and to abuse me at every chance they get. They think it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know this whole story. This is the first time I've told anybody the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And what I am hoping and praying for is that somebody out there does a decent, right thing and steps up and tries to help.
So what sort of help are you looking for?
Whether it be legal, moral, emotional support, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
People need to stop being so cruel. I mean, after this World Trade Center thing, for God's sakes, if nothing else out of this situation, we need to learn to pull together.
Mm-hmm.
We need to learn to treat each other right.
Well, we're talking with Pamela Lee Spires, who's calling us from, I guess, from Watsonville, where you live.
Yes.
And if folks want to, of course, they can call into the show and express their concerns, interests, and reactions. We don't have you in the studio, and we don't have more than one line, so we have to kind of do this sort of in a separated way. But if people want to get in touch with you or leave a message, they can always call the Huff line, and I'll pass that on to you. That's 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Or if people want to call into the studio, it's 427-3772. Is there more you want to say about this, Pamela?
I don't know what else to say. What can I say? I just feel that being in the homeless situation and fearing that I'll be there again because of these complications, that people in authority use their positions of authority to be abusive and condemn. If you're not a criminal, they're going to find another way to take you down. And what I mean by that is by discrediting you or defaming you. There's many, many ways to commit murder in this country without having to go to prison for it. And I don't mean murder physically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many different ways of hurting people in this country, and they'll do it. Don't think it won't happen to you, because it will.
Well, you might want to, of course, you're in a wheelchair, right?
Yes, I am.
So it's hard for you to get around. I was going to suggest you come to town and say hi to the folks at Camp Paradise. But they're kind of out of the way.
No, they all have my best wishes and love. I know everybody there, and I'm rooting for them 100%. And if there's anything I can do, tell them to give me a holler. I totally agree with what they're doing, and I hope they make it.
Well, that's great. Pamela, thank you for calling in. We've been talking to Pamela Lee Spires, and if you want to call back, of course, call back at any time. The show airs both on Thursday at 6 until 8 and also on Sundays from 11 in the morning to 1:30 in the afternoon. Hey, thank you for calling.
Thank you for letting me speak.
Hey, thank you.
All right, you have a good one.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now the lines are open in case you want to have your own thoughts expressed on the radio about what you've just heard, or you have some other subject you want to discuss. A lot of folks, of course, are talking about the World Trade Center mega catastrophe, bombing, planing, whatever you will. My concern, of course, is because I have no relatives or friends or people who are directly, probably do actually know people who have been killed in that, but it hasn't hit home with me yet. My concern is the potential reaction that we're going to be seeing around Santa Cruz in terms of police state-style crackdown, but here's another call.
Hi, you're on free radio.
Yeah, Robert, I need to talk to you off air.
Okay, well, why don't you hang on until the next recorded segment and then give me a call.
Okie dokie.
And I'll engage in that secret conversation and give you the gist of all the juicy details in a bit. But as I said, you hear a lot of flag waving going on in different parts of the country around this issue, and I guess my concern is here in Santa Cruz that this screaming for blood against, quote, terrorists, and not quote terrorists, real terrorists, not be turned into a blanket excuse to go after every dissident in town and to engage in police-style type security measures, which we have, we've seen how useless these kinds of security measures are, of course, but that's not going to stop all kinds of millions and millions of dollars from being poured into more security measures. Here's an incoming call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, I was really feeling bad for your last caller, the experiences that she's had, and I just wanted to kind of relate it to, I think, what you were kind of talking about, which is the suffering that people experience at the hands of our military all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happened to her is probably quite a bit less damaging than what's happened to many people around the world. So I thought that was something that I wanted to say, that, you know, I understand that I've had really bad experiences with the police, but that's comparatively mild to the terrorism that people have experienced all over the world at the hands of American soldiers or American plans, American policies.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I wanted to let people know was that there's going to be a candle lighting tomorrow night. It says Friday night at 7 p.m., step out of your door, stop your car, or step out of your establishment and light a candle. We will show the world that Americans are strong and united together against terrorism. Please pass this to everyone on your email list. We need to research everyone across the United States, or we need to reach everyone in the mm-hmm. United States quickly. I agree with this, that it's good that Americans show that they stand together against terrorism. However, I also want to say that we need to stand together against the terrorism that our own country inflicts upon other peoples. And I was on the air earlier today saying that I really, one of the things is I'm not so sure that I really am going to be grieving all of the people that died at the World Trade Center, because I have a feeling that not all of those people were people that were completely innocent of crimes against humanity. I could almost see in my mind's eye the man who just returned from Thailand after raping several 12-year-old children. So I feel like maybe some of the people, I mean, I don't even really feel like the blood is off of my hands. You know, I feel kind of guilty by association as an American, not resisting the establishment so much that it crumbles, because I feel like we really need to be doing that. And I don't know what you think of that, but I felt almost like this is like a wake-up call for Americans to understand that they are not above the damage that our government is doing to people because we're not resisting it strongly enough.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
Well, you know, I actually pulled out a few pages off the internet that I liked, which I unfortunately don't have immediately handy. I was going to make copies and start distributing them, about how the main thing I'm concerned about is you see these headlines, you know, strike back, and now the America is in a war and so forth, as though there's sort of a fantasy here that there's an enemy that the U.S. military can somehow focus its guns against, or the American people can all unite around and oppose. And you look at the history of the last 100 years the U.S. isn't the only one that does this, but it's certainly one of the biggest offenders, the major arms dealer in the world, the primary nuclear power, and, you know, then, of course, the economic chains are huge and immense. It's a situation where, yeah, it is unrealistic for the United States to expect this kind of thing isn't going to happen at some point if it doesn't address issues. On the other hand, you know, what do you do to someone who turns to you and says, well, suppose this kind of terrorism had happened inside of Cuba? What would your reaction be there? I suppose it would be different. You would take a different stance.
Well, if it was inside of Cuba, and I guess it would depend on who the terrorist was.
Suppose you didn't know.
Suppose I didn't know if it happened in Cuba. You know, that's a really good question. I think I would I would feel the same way that I feel except for I wouldn't be so pissed off at Americans for not, like, understanding the amount of violence that happens around the world. Like, basically what I see the American people doing is ganging up behind George Bush and going, we are a nation, and we're going to kick your ass, whoever you are, instead of saying, we've been kicking people's asses, and this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's really frustrating for me as someone who's been labeled as an American because I was born in this country, and I fail to have the resources to get out right now, which is something I really want to do, especially as I consider how my fellow Americans are attacking people that are from the Middle East because they think that that's who's, you know, the terrorist is, and it's not even, I mean, it's just crazy. They're attacking American citizens because of the way they look, and that's been happening since the beginning of America.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sick of America, and I'm sick of the way that Americans perceive themselves, and they, like, justify their privilege, and they're fighting against an enemy that has already been beaten in so many ways. And it's like, it makes me really irritated that people aren't putting these connections together and saying, wait, we don't want more war. Please stop right now.
Yeah. Well, I'm of course concerned, as I was saying, about the local scene, and I'm not much in touch with, I haven't heard of any accounts of Arab Americans being beaten up or harassed.
At all?
Well, not here in Santa Cruz.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, and nor have I seen any immediate repercussions in Santa Cruz either. But again, it may take a while for that to be seen, if and maybe it won't be seen. Maybe there'll be a positive kind of response. I mean,
mm-hmm.
The Sentinel, of course, is the antithesis of that. When you look at their coverage, it was at least yesterday's coverage.
Attack.
Yeah, right. Attacked. It's, you know,
so,
it's the old Pearl Harbor. You know,
yeah.
They want to push those buttons and get people rolling with that stuff. The thing, though, is that I want to turn back to, you know, civil rights for homeless people, because that's really what I try to focus on.
That was one of the things that I found really amazing about a caller that I got the other day. She was talking about how,
mm-hmm.
you know, she really loves Santa Cruz, but she was a homeless rights advocate, and I couldn't understand how she could be saying she loves Santa Cruz when the city council is the way that it is about homeless people. But yeah, if you could, let's...
Well, the community is different than the city council. That's the, you can love Santa Cruz, I guess, and
but
realize...
But the community votes the city council in, right? And, like, the community allows the city council to get away with the shit that they're doing.
Well, remember that most people in the community are doing two or three jobs, and they have enough, you know, I mean, they would like to all unite and get together and overthrow rent and oppression and so forth, but it's not an easy thing to find the trust and solidarity to do that, and... In the meantime, you survive as best you can. I mean, that's, I think, what most people do, and it's just the reality of it. Some people...
I mean, oh, no, I got to help my baby. She just
people
got
have
owie.
Children to take care of. I'll talk to you later.
Okay, I'm listening, though, so if you want to answer, go ahead. I
sure.
Mean, go ahead, bye.
No problem. So, yeah, I mean, the city council is notoriously bad, but that doesn't mean the community is notoriously bad. I think that most people... you know, they don't have, first of all, you don't have a lot of, to run for city council requires money and political connections, and you have things together to do it, and, you know, even candidates that I liked, like Steve Argue, got us, you know, 3,000 votes, I believe it was. You know, it's hard to get a campaign together and then not turn into a politician, that's what I find, and it's... That's why people ask me why I don't run for city council. I respond, I run from city council, and I think what we need to do is establish community organizations that really express the community will in terms of direct forums where people can bring the kinds of complaints and concerns that Pamela Lee Spires had that I heard expressed by two men at the Citizens Police Rah-Rah Board, the Citizens Police Review Board, on Monday. They had their once per month meeting on Monday at the City Council Chambers, the Citizens Police Review Board, and there were two individuals who actually gave very dynamic testimony. I'm going to be playing it probably on Sunday because we're going to probably run out of time shortly. What I'm going to work on now is the farmer's market, and the farmer's market is a situation I've been following, and probably most of you out there who regularly listen know what that's about. The farmers market has become more conservative, called in the police more frequently, more responsive to complaints by, I don't know, the Downtown Association, possibly some conservative merchants. Who knows who they're responding to, but as I mentioned before, the drummers across the street have been driven away from the church lawn. The folks who normally were congregating with political tables and dancing and sharing and so forth and singing and colorful garb on the sidewalk along, I guess it's Cedar Street, side of the farmers market, have been cleared away by police. The areas that have been used by people to politically table have been meshed off, so that first it was orange mesh, then it was yellow police tape. Now, this last week, it was green mesh. Just a large, blank, bare space that people don't use and that nobody can use. And indeed, when Mumia activist brought out his table last week, he was driven away. I'm going to read you the statement that he would have said to the city council, and he probably will be saying on the 18th. For those of you who don't know, the city council meeting on September 11th on Tuesday was postponed with all its agenda items until the 18th. So, you folks, you will have a chance to deal with that, and it's not so bad that those items were postponed, because most of those items were bad items. They were, there's nothing particularly good going on at city council, and so, but I mean, stuff that you have to essentially resist or criticize is what I see happening. There's a memorandum of understanding with the police force that really should be linked up with the demand that they be required to appear when complaints, such as Pamela Lee Spire's complaint, you heard her on the air speaking. And I know that to some folks who don't regard her as entirely credible, by the way, I've heard some criticism of her at different points, but I wanted to give her a chance to speak her own mind. So there's going to be stuff coming up in the city council, and this would have come up in the city council. What I'm going to read to you is a statement by John Thielking. At about 4 p.m. on September 5th, 2001, I just finished setting up a table with Mumia literature and voter registration cards on it when Janet of the Farmers Market, she's the executive director, I believe, or her public relations officer, she's the woman who was threatening me with arrest about a month ago because I was speaking to a crowd of people about how abusive the farmers market was now becoming, with the management calling the police and again doing this kind of meshing off of free speech areas, not allowing people to use them, harassing people because of their lifestyle. Anyway, when Janet of the Farmer's Market, and this is John Thielking speaking, tells me that I'm not allowed to have a table in the Farmer's Market. I did not get Janet's name at the time of the incident, but another person advised me of who this was after I showed him her picture. I pointed out to her that I have voter registration cards on the table. She says she doesn't care about that, that I should remove the table anyway. I tried to tell her that it is my right to be there. She says that this is my warning, and the next time I'll have to deal directly with the police. I asked to take her picture, and she agrees, so here is her picture as evidence. I had the table set up next to the bicycle lockers. This space could not be used for any other purpose other than a small table. Even after Janet moved a sign into the area to attempt to block off the space, there was still room for the table, and I did move it back into the space for a short time before ultimately deciding to leave the table on top of the sidewalk. Janet had advised me that leaving the table on the sidewalk did not meet with her approval either, since I was blocking traffic. She implied that she would complain to the police about this also and said that I could be cited for blocking the sidewalk. At the time, she said that there was very little traffic, so I retorted, "What traffic?" There were no witnesses that I recall to this incident. I have included additional photos which show, A, the table with just the voter registration cards on it, B, the table with the voter registration cards and all the other literature that was on it. The table is in the same place as Janet was objecting to it when she said it was not allowed to be in the farmer's market. And picture C is of Janet asking me to leave. A later picture, D, shows the table after I'd moved it onto the sidewalk for the first time. Having it there directly interferes with my ability to do business, since the police could at any time have ordered me to remove the table since it was across just about one-third of the sidewalk. Others have told me that this may not be something to worry about, but I think it is. I believe I have a right to set up a political table inside of the farmer's market so long as it does not interfere with any of the vendors who have paid to use their portion of the space. The farmer's market is a public space. Preventing me from setting up a political table there is a violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. And specifically, interfering with the voter registration process is, I believe, a separate federal offense. At this point, I am requesting your response as to the appropriateness of having political tables at the farmer's market. You may have this letter and the pictures for your reference. Thank you. Sincerely, John Thielking. And I'm also going to play now for you the beginnings of my travel through the farmer's market yesterday, which became quite a journey. I don't want to call it the fascist farmers market, because that's a little too, trite. But you two here at a table here on the sidewalk with some bumper stickers, some photos, looks like of somebody being taken into custody. and some Earth First t-shirts. What's this all about?
Well, we're trying to raise money for the four kids who are in three tree sits right now, protecting five trees. And we're also trying to raise money for our friend Horizon, who was arrested, and also for Victim, who's over there, who got arrested and is now out on bond.
And how's the fundraising coming?
It's coming. The more we get, the better off everybody is.
And if people want to contribute funds, how can they do this?
Well, we table every Wednesday at the farmer's market here, and that's the best way. We also have
the farmer's No Hippies Need Apply market.
Right?
Or they can send money to our P.O. box.
There you go.
They
can check out the website for Earth First in Santa Cruz, which is a pretty easy website, and from their website they can get all the information to send money.
Yeah.
That would be EFSC.com on the World Wide Web.
World Wide Web. The entire world's web. Even Charlotte's web.
So what's happening today? Have any police officers come up and offer to help you move this table out into the street?
We asked them if they were registered to vote, and they've already said that they were. But we ask them every week.
So, what about this table? Have you actually been approached by police and told to move on? Or?
No.
Nope.
They can't because we have voter registration, and that makes it legal to be here.
Or so the mythology goes until they consult the rule book. Any other hassles here? I noticed they've got this green mesh. You know, first it was orange mesh, then it was yellow, don't cross the police lines, ribbons. Now it's green mesh, which are preventing people from using a perfectly usable area next to that tree for tables. So what do you make of this? Do you think the farmers, have any comments from farmers market people about your being excluded from these areas?
We don't really feel excluded because we found our place, which is
just outside the green mesh.
The green mesh.
Yeah, but nevertheless, there are people that are coming in and out of the farmer's market and see the table, and they're very receptive. Sometimes you get lost in all that maze of all those fruits and vegetables, but when you're standing out here and there's a constant flow of traffic, you know, to and fro.
Sir, are you an Earth Firster yourself?
Well, of course. Aren't you, Robert?
I have no affiliation with any group here.
I don't see any t-shirts on these folks either.
I don't know. I see one over there.
Oh, there's an Earth Firster.
Yeah.
This woman works for Captain Morgan Rome, actually.
All right, then. Anybody have any comments they want to make to Free Radio Santa Cruz about any issues around the Earth First issues or the farmer's market?
On an Earth First note, the best way to help out is to organize your own communities and develop your own safeguards to keep your own watersheds, and to help out the activists who are doing direct nonviolent actions in the forest. They need all the help they can get. It'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're talking to Spencer.
Spencer, you had a little encounter with the deputies out at Greyhound Rock.
Yes, it was on a weekday about a week ago, and we're sleeping in my truck, and it's a newer vehicle, and the cops actually just told us to leave, but then there was a Volkswagen bus parked there, and they proceeded to search the bus, and there was nobody in it, and tore it apart, and towed the bus, and that's what happened out of Greyhound Rock.
I see. Did you get any photos, take any names, et cetera?
I wanted to take pictures, but I didn't want to walk up and involve myself. Because of their actions.
How many deputies were involved?
There was two different cars, three deputies.
Did they indicate why they were doing this?
They said we weren't allowed to sleep there, and I said...
They claim that the vehicle was asleep, is that the idea?
They knew the people were there somewhere camping out because the vehicle was there overnight. So they stepped over giving it a ticket like they should have, and they thought that they could just do whatever because there was something going on illegal.
Did you ever find who owned the vehicle? Or?
Actually, the kids that owned it, I talked to them in the morning and told them what happened, and they went and dealt with it somehow.
So where are you sleeping generally now? Are you in your vehicle somewhere in the city or outside?
I've been here in the city tonight. I actually drive up sometimes to Guerneville. But
it's a ways to go to sleep there.
Yeah, actually, I like to go hang out up there in the Redwoods as well. And I like it here, but definitely some friction going on.
Tell me what that candlelight vision was all about there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't turn off. Stay. All right. And tonight I noticed a sign here on the Farmer's Market sign. Candlelight vigil tonight, 9 p.m. Clock Tower. Of course, by the time it's, you're listening to this on the air, vigil will have happened, but of course, a day and a half ago, the World Trade Center was planed, so to speak. To two locals, your name is?
Walter.
And you are?
Eloise.
You have some association, the two of you, or is this just, you're just good friends?
We're just friends.
All right. Well, you notice we now have three police, well, I guess they aren't here. They wandered off a lot. I don't know if you've heard recently, the Farmers Market has recently taken the tack, I should say, the board of directors of running off undesirables from the sidewalk. They don't allow tables by the side except for they mesh off the areas with this green mesh. You'll notice here that keeps turning off. Any thoughts on that? Do you feel safer now that you know that the wrong kind of people has been excluded? Possibly they might have some paper airplanes and throw them at you or something?
No, I think it's a really silly waste of time.
But don't you think we need more security here in the Farmers Market? What about the dangerous artichoke mints?
Yeah, that's terrible. So who gave them the authority to declare who's undesirable and desirable?
Janet, the head of the Farmer's Market, of course, the executive director. You'll see her wandering around here.
Based on what criteria?
She's a wise woman.
Really?
That's her perspective on the situation, I assume. Are you both in Santa Cruz, or are you outside the city?
I live in Rio del Mar, and I come here because I love the variety of fruits, vegetables, and people.
Really? And you? You come here, don't you find it a little troublesome seeing these people with dreadlocks and strange racial hues?
No, not at all.
What about these homeless types hanging out downtown? Wouldn't it be better if we just sort of, you know, used the old Giuliani approach and got some of them relocated to a happier place, maybe 10 miles west?
10 miles west in the ocean, right?
I won't tell if you won't tell.
Right. Well, this is Santa Cruz, right?
This was Santa Cruz. We're coming into the 21st
right.
century here. Anything you want to say to the Free Radio Santa Cruz audience?
People with dreadlocks are notoriously peaceful. I feel very secure at this market.
Yes, but our president has assured us what we need is retaliation in a more meaningful, straightforward, and tough way. This peaceful shit has gotten us nowhere. Wouldn't you agree?
Right. Have we ever tried it yet, though?
I can see you're obviously not the kind of people that really we need to talk to at this time. But thank you for your time. And where's my hug? All right, we're talking to
Don Dolan.
John, you were actually present in San Jose at the hearing for Jim Costner, who's accused of, he admits to having redecorated with extreme prejudice the statue of Christopher Columbus in the San Jose City Hall back in, I guess, March or April. And now he, of course, faces trial on the 17th with no lawyer, in pro per, after, of course, what's likely to be a massive wave of reaction, hostility to lefty activists, maybe, is one way of putting it. And you were in court observing the last hearing. What's your perspective on this?
Up until yesterday, I thought he had a chance because he's a great orator, and at the summation, he'll probably blow their socks off. But, you know, after the World Trade Center thing, I got a feeling there isn't going to be too much sympathy for him just because they'll lump him in with every other kind of, you know, wacko around. He asked the judge if his papers weren't ready or he didn't have them by the trial date, if he could have another extension, and the judge said, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Well, that may be, it may be that his whole trial may be postponed on the 17th because he has not yet been in a position of being able to get his papers together because the prison was locked down yesterday, the jail, and then after that, prior to that, the papers were sent to the jail, and they wouldn't let him have it because they said it was a security risk. You know, all those manila files could be used to, I'm not quite sure what they could be used for, but anyway, it was considered a security risk, or for some reason it was returned to the lawyer who tried to get them to him. Anything else at the hearing? And many people show up?
There was, I think, four of us. There were a bunch of other defendants for various cases, and he told some of them, in no uncertain terms, that they were not having any more extensions. But he didn't say that to Jim, so...
Well, Jim, of course, has been held in jail on $35,000 bail, even though he made that bail once already, and then in a slippery, and I would have to say, probably not illegal, but certainly slimy move, and sort of violates the spirit of fairness, the district attorney went and got a different kind of indictment against him, had the original bail exonerated, and went to a grand jury and got new charges leveled against him, which were actually less than the prior charges. He's being charged with felony vandalism. But he didn't tell the grand jury and the judge that took the information from the grand jury that Jim had already made his bail before and met his court appearances. So he was given a $35,000 bail again. Actually, I guess initially it was a $50,000 bail. And then we actually sat in the DA's office at a presence there, got the judge to release him on his own recognizance, but because of this new indictment, he was held up on a $35,000 bail again, which he could not roll over in an appropriate way. So he's been in jail ever since, for 2 months now, has had no opportunity to prepare his case. Not that I believe that smashing a statue of Christopher Columbus in broad daylight with no legal defense team is a very good idea, but I can understand the motivation behind it.
I was present when he first told the judge he wanted to defend himself, and the judge told him, you know, only an idiot would do that. But Jim is a great orator, and he'll definitely be at a disadvantage to most of the trial, but at the very end, the summation, they'll never know what hit him. He'll just blow their socks off. And if he has, you know, a reasonable number of sympathetic, you know, Chicano jurors, he's got a chance of being... you know, getting a hung jury, and even a remote chance of being acquitted outright if he really, you know, gives a great speech.
When talking to a nameless legal advisor, he suggested to me that another advantage of Jim's defending himself, which generally is not a good idea, is that his only hope is what we call jury nullification or jury independence.